live rating reaction. Who's rated us? Where have they rated us? What have they rated us, Alice?
One rating. 5 out of 5.
Oh, yeah.
Did you do that?
Nah. Now you know who it is. It's Maddie. Maddie did that.
Oh, I should do it.
Thanks, babe.
Thanks, Maddie.
We think just last time, this time we can thank Maddie. Rating us 5 stars. Everyone else, go and rate us 5 stars.
It's Discworld. It's Discworld. Podcast. Analysis. Yeah. Woo!
So I'm Josh.
I'm Alice.
And we're the Unseen Academicals.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're back to do part two of Witches Abroad. And we said last episode that it was going to be a two-parter.
But surprise.
I think it's going to be a three-parter. We'll see how this one goes. But turns out there's a lot of stuff going on in this book because I think, as I said in the last episode, this is tackling an entire genre of things that have been incredibly culturally influential. There's lots of stuff going on. I have crazy theories about simulacras and pastiche. So yeah, when I said Bill Doxerman was as technical as we were going to get, I lied.
He did. He sucked me in.
I'm sorry. We've been promising the talk about Granny Weatherwax's conservatism and things. That's going to be saved for part three. Part two, we are just going to focus on the fairy tales.
So if you don't like fairy tales.
Yeah, lots of Disney princess talk coming up. But yeah, specifically, we talked about the fairy tales that they encountered on the road last time. This time we're talking about the fairy tales that they encounter while in Genua. So.
And at the end of last podcast, we had the realization that Genua meant genuine.
Genuine, yeah. We did have that.
Good.
It was a revelation. And a couple of follows up on some things from last episode coming up. But yeah, this episode we're going to be looking at primarily the fairy tale Cinderella, Bluebeard, the Frog Prince, and some Disney stuff and Snow White. So that's the agenda for today. First, a few follow-ups from last time, because we brought up Rumpelstiltskin, and it turns out the version of Rumpelstiltskin I was talking about where he gets stuck in the queen's vagina and he can't get pulled out. And I didn't know where I'd heard that, and I couldn't find it. Turns out, it comes from Pratchett. It's in the second Science of Discworld book.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. You haven't read these ones, have you, Alice?
No.
So the way they work is they're wizard stories.
Okay.
And there's, like, alternating chapters where you get a piece of wizard story written by Pratchett, and then a piece of, like, non-fiction chapter sort of explaining the science of some of the concepts that are being written in the story.
Okay.
Presumably written by his co-editors, Ian Stewart and Jack Cohen. I don't know how much of a hand Pratchett has in the science stuff that's being written, but in one of the sections the authors there, they claim that Rumpelstiltskin was a tale to program the idea that female masturbation leads to sterility.
Oh,
saying, remember the tale with the miller's daughter? They put her in the barn and tell her to spin straw into gold, and then she virginally sits on a little stick that becomes a little man, who, when his name is finally identified, jumps in to plug the lady very intimately, and the assembled soldiers can't pull him out.
Yikes. So
that's where I remembered this from.
I don't know where to start with that.
Well, I can't find another source for this.
Okay, so this is just Pratchett being Pratchett?
Well, I can find vague references on the internet. Maybe it's out there. I haven't gone, like, fully down the rabbit hole, but I haven't been able to find just a thing to say, hey, here's a version where this happens.
Mm-hmm.
But either way, they cite it in The Science of Discworld, and they say that if you doubt this interpretation, note the indirection. What is his name? What is his name that recurs in the story? What is the name of a stilt with a rumpled skin?
Oh, no. A penis?
It's a penis. Well, that's what they're suggesting, right? The rumpled stilt skin penis thing, though, of course, comes from Freud.
Oh, no.
Yeah, right?
Josh! None of this trickery. Go on.
In his 1913 essay on the occurrence of dreams in material from fairy tales, Freud characterizes the queen's room as her vagina.
No.
And Rumpelstiltskin entering it as the penis itself, which he claims is confirmed the door's narrow door and steep stairs. I don't know why, but that's Freud's evidence. Maybe if I read more psychoanalysis stuff, I would know why, but I'm not going to because it's trash.
It's trash. I was going to say, we're making fun of psychoanalysis.
Oh, yeah.
I'm like, are we allowed to do that on this podcast? Okay.
But we have to deal with psychoanalysis if we're going to talk about Rumpelstiltskin penis stuff, because that's where it comes from.
Okay.
And we're going to have to talk about it in part three with all the mirror shit, because mirrors and fairy tales and, yeah. So get ready. Freud further characterizes the queen's ignorance of Rumpelstiltskin's name as evidence of her ignorance and envy for the penis.
Oh, it's getting worse.
Right? I mean, this is pretty basic psychoanalysis stuff, and this is why no one takes this shit seriously. A further influential argument regarding Rumpelstiltskin was made by Harry Rand in his article Who Was Rumpelstiltskin from the year 2000, wherein he argues that Rumpelstiltskin represents a specifically flaccid penis.
Wow.
Yes. Now, his argument is etymological, claiming that rumple equals wrinkle. wrinkled or contracted. Stilt is an erect pole, and skin is skin. So you put all this together, what's a contracted, wrinkled pole? It's the flaccid penis, right? And he argues this is why he demands a child from the queen, which he says is the only thing a flaccid penis absolutely cannot create. So flaccid penis is capable of creating all other things. Yes.
But can a flaccid penis write Hamlet?
If you get enough of them in a room with enough typewriters. Flipping around, bashing the keys over an infinite time period. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Other psychoanalysis have linked Rumpelstiltskin to the clitoris.
Okay.
The idea being that the queen spinning at night represents masturbation.
Or she could just be spinning.
Yeah. Rand's argument, however, is knowingly based on Edgar Taylor's 1823 English mistranslation, see what I did there, of the Grimm's German story, Rumpelstiltschen.
Oh, no.
Therefore, the suffix schen, or small, implying small or child.
So now it's a small dick?
Well, it's not skin, is the point, which would be translated as haut, I think, H-A-U-T. So, in fact, it's not even skin in the English translation. It's stilts, plural. So, stilts, then kin, meaning a small child.
Okay, so a little kid.
But the etymological argument, it's not even the right words that he's translating there. And Rand acknowledges that the English naming is also Taylor's invention.
Mm-hmm.
So this implication, you know, isn't part of the original story because it comes from a translation. But he also characterizes it as cannily intuitive, suggesting that it possibly reveals an old English name for the same figure. So somehow translation is revealing some kind of implicit meaning. This is bullshit.
I mean, now I'm thinking of Penelope spinning her veil while Odysseus is away. Like, was the whole time she was just,
That's actually not bad. That's probably out there somewhere, right?
Right?
Yeah.
She's just wanking off the whole time. And good on her.
She is doing it to delay her suitors.
Yeah. So she's just having a good time.
Psychoanalysis are onto something.
Done.
I'm sure there's an article I can find out there about
women spinning things. Mm-hmm.
The critic John Rosengrant takes a more sensible approach in his 2008 article, The Name of the Helper, pointing out that actual folklorists often explicitly or implicitly fault most psychoanalytic approaches to fairy tales for limiting themselves only to the most familiar variant of each tale,
right,
leading to an overemphasis on the importance of details with limited generality and the overlooking of important details not found in the particular variant. So again, that whole flaccid penis argument was based on a specific English translation rather than all the versions of Rumpelstiltskin.
Yep, okay.
Rosengrant looks at other variations of what are called Name of the Helper folktales. These are like categories of folktales where the end is that you have to guess the name of the person who's helped them. So he looks at other variations of this tale and finds that none of them emphasize phallic sexuality so much.
Huh.
He finds instead that these stories illustrate a broader ambivalence about development, of which the phallic meaning is merely a specific manifestation. He also points out that the name of the helper differs in each story, leading to a number of different meanings that can be read into them, most of which emphasize children or childhood. So they're about growing up, not through sexuality, but through the discovery of language, which makes more sense, right, if they got to know the name. Because
mm-hmm.
I don't really know where knowing the name of the penis really comes into.
Barry! Okay.
That's what yours is called? And the Hungarian psychoanalyst Sandor Ferenczi associated adolescence with a period of magic thinking and magic words.
Okay.
Which Freud further connected to widespread, quote, primitive beliefs that one's true name partakes of one's essence or soul, and knowing the name of another gives control over him.
Oh, no, you've just ruined Rothfuss for me. Never mind.
Well, it's Le Guin as well, though, right? This is the idea of the power through language thing that we've been talking about.
Yep.
So this is all tied in there.
Untie it. So, where did the penis go?
Well, in the...
Just in the... All right. How do they refer to Rumpelstiltskin and witches abroad again?
They refer to the long girl with the pigtails and a tower, Rumpelstiltschnell or someone. So it's literally that.
It's barely
the only
a passing influence. Yeah. Okay.
And now I've gone down the psychoanalytic, I was going to say penis hole, but sure.
Freud would be proud.
I've gone down the psychoanalytic urethra.
I need to terminate our friendship.
Oh, but it's also relevant because this is in the science of Discworld. The other fairy tale I needed to look up after last episode was Puss in Boots, which you pointed out Grebo was probably an allusion to. Now, the Puss in Boots story comes from Perrault, although there is a Grimm's version, which was omitted from later collections because of its French origins. In that one, Puss in Boots' enemy is a great sorcerer who he tricks into shape-shifting into a mouse so that he can eat him, which I guess is alluded to in Witches Abroad when Grebo eats the vampire bat.
Yeah, I think that's the right link.
But it's just sort of, it's a throwaway scene in Witches Abroad because, like, he just eats a vampire bat for no reason, which also sort of stuffs up Carpe Jugulum.
Huh?
I didn't really find any other connection. Did you ever look at this fairy tale at all?
Very briefly, and also didn't find anything.
Perhaps the most interesting thing I found out about Puss in Boots was that Perrault's version, rather than a sorcerer, it's an ogre.
That was cool.
Yeah. So, and the ogre receives Puss in Boots as politely as an ogre is able to do, asking him if he would like to rest a while when he shows up at his castle, which I thought was, pretty Shrek-esque.
Yeah.
Last time, you break the rules, you go rogue, you kick over the conventions right at the start of the episode to list two things you don't like.
Oh, yeah.
And one of the things you say you don't like is that it's a bit like Shrek.
Yeah.
But then all we do is talk about how much we like Shrek.
We love Shrek. Shrek is nothing else. Only Shrek. I know it doesn't make sense.
I wasn't sure why it wasn't negative that it was like Shrek.
Why it was negative that it was like Shrek.
Yeah, why it was like, we like Shrek.
I think because it felt to me strained because I was like, oh, you're just copying Shrek the whole time. But I knew deep down that it's not copying Shrek. This came first. Shrek is a copy of all of that.
But just that you've seen this stuff.
I've seen Shrek and I've seen Shrek, all the things that came from Shrek, and it just felt like that again. Yeah, it was annoying. I felt sad.
Do we need to address the secret reverse Shrek?
That was a sex move?
That was in the, well, it ended up in the bonus episode, bonus section of last episode. But yes, we contemplate what the secret reverse Shrek would be.
Did we come up with a...
Well, no, in the interim, I sent you an article about a guy who's made a fleshlight like Shrek's ear.
And I sent that to everyone I know.
So I think that guy's figured it out. That is the secret reverse Shrek. You can carry around with you. You need me.
Oh, no.
Oh, yes. And the last bit of follow-up stuff about the Oz things, because I didn't talk about them enough. But I did find in an article by Rebecca Ancy de Rosario. So she used to work at Monash, but I saw her in passing, but I never actually interacted with her, and she doesn't work there anymore. But in her 2018 book, Fashion in the Fairy Tale Tradition, she points out that Witches Abroad, like Bound's Oz books, features witches who absorb characteristics of the fairy godmother, which seems obvious, but we didn't actually point that out last episode. And she also observes how Granny Weatherwax laments that witches should wear black while wearing a white gown at the ball, whereas we were talking about how Bound's witches wear white.
Yeah.
And her description of how Witches Abroad tangles with the fairy godmother and her role in controlling stories also prompted me to connect the idea that we mentioned last episode of Marina Warner's suggestion that writers often represented themselves as fairy godmothers in their stories.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea that the fairy godmothers are the writers who are writing the fairy tales, and Lilith is the fairy godmother who's writing the fairy tales.
Yep.
This is all implicit, but seeing this written out, like, explicitly for me, I was like, oh, yeah, that's it. That's what's going on.
Yeah, nice. Yeah.
And Do Rosario also connects this to the idea of the fates, writing stories for people. It's all soup.
Soup.
But yes, that's just some loose threads from our last episode, spun into gold, which means...
Via masturbation?
Sure. This was a bit of a wank. But yeah, so we can now turn our attention to the fairy tales focused on in the genuine section of Witches Abroad, the biggest and most obvious one being Cinderella.
Woo.
So the most popular version of the story that we're familiar with comes from Charles Perrault's French Cendrillon from 1697. I don't know if that's just a translation thing, but in the version I'm using, the 2009 Oxford University Press edition, she's called Cinderbum, which I thought was pretty amusing. Yeah. I got ya. Normally you don't laugh at my little words I throw in, but you like that one.
I like toilet humour. That wasn't obvious.
Else is gone.
Okay, Cinderbum.
The modern suffix Ella is a variation of the name Elaine, the name of Sir Lancelot's lover in the King Arthur myth, which will become more relevant, well, I was going to say next episode, but not part three, in next book, Lords and Ladies, the Arthur mythos will become a thing. And the name Elaine was also popularised by Alfred Tennyson's 1859 poem, Idylls of the King, where he describes her as Elaine the Fair and Lovable.
That's nice.
Elaine, in turn, is a derivative of Helen, which is derived from the Greek Helios, or the sun, and connected to ideas of female beauty through Homer's Helen in the Odyssey and the Iliad. Imbrella's proper name, Ella Saturday, therefore makes her a beautiful sunny Saturday.
Oh, that's nice.
That is nice. Much better than Cinderbum. But yeah, Cinderella, this is the beauty fame from nothing thing that you were suggesting about unseen academicals with Juliet, Billie Eilish, and things like that. And indeed, Pratchett makes multiple references to Umbrella in unseen academicals. So in that book, Juliet likens one of her fashion shows to a fairy story. Then when Glenda tells her that they don't all have happy endings and that she has a steady job already that should not be lightly thrown away, Pepe responds, "No, it should be hurled with great force. What is this, Umbrella? The wand has been waved, the court is cheering, a score of handsome princes are waiting to sign up for just a sniff of her slipper, and you want her to go back to work making pumpkins?" And later, Glenda asked Trev, "Ever heard of Umbrella?" "Everyone's heard of Umbrella. Well, you might not be my first choice for Prince Charming, but there's probably plenty worse."
Yikes.
So here they're referring to Umbrella as a story,
it's already been written. Yeah,
it's the same rather as than a person. So I don't know if that's like either Pratchett's forgetting he already did this.
Mm.
We did talk about how unseen academicals coincides with these Alzheimer's, but that's not the accusation I'm making.
Mm.
I'm more pointing out this seems like an oversight. Or he's playing with the idea that Umbrella's life got turned into a fairy tale anyway.
Oh, yeah.
With charming princes
and a
happy
ending. Yeah.
Which would imply that Lilith won after all.
Yeah.
But I think that's reading way too much into it. But it does seem...
Oh, I don't mind that.
It's cool. There's just nothing there to indicate in unseen academicals that he's deliberately connecting it. It just seems like he came up with the Umbrella joke.
This is how many books after? 40 books after?
25 books later, I think. Unseen academicals.
That's a lot of books.
Yeah. It seems like it's meant to be an Easter egg, but it seems to conflict, so I don't know.
Okay.
I like our reading, but I don't know if it's supported in the text. Bro's moral for Cinderella, however, reads, "You have a great advantage if you receive at your birth good breeding, courage, sense, a ready wit, and other things of comparable worth, but that is not enough unless you know how best to use such precious gifts. You need a godfather or a godmother to show what you must do in order to succeed."
This is where my Spencer stuff comes in. Do you want it now?
Go for it.
And this is from Edmund Spencer's The Fairy Queen, which is an epic poem.
Pretty epic.
Peter and I are going through book 6 at the moment, which is on courtesy, and I was like, but what? Why is that a virtue that a knight needs to know? And what we found along the way is actually courtesy encompasses all of the other virtues, and Spencer's been slowly building one which leads to another and to another, etc. But it's at that cusp in history where we're moving away from the idea that, you know, nobles are noble by birth and peasants are villains, because, you know, the original etymology of villain.
I do not.
And just meant peasant.
Like villager.
Yeah, essentially, and then they sort of took on that connotation because the implication was that if you were highborn, you were naturally good, and if you were lowborn, you were naturally bad because God wanted that for you, and sucks to be lowborn.
Right.
But we're now moving towards more of a meritocracy at the time that Spencer is writing.
Which is when?
1590s.
Oh, so late 1590s.
Yeah, yeah. Elizabeth is on the throne. We've had the Spanish Armada, the Irish Rebellion.
So contemporary with Shakespeare. 1590.
Just before. Yeah, yeah. At the same time.
Yeah.
Yeah, he dies soon after that.
Okay.
Yeah, he's on his way out. And then Shakespeare and then Milton. This is all to say that in book 6, he's really, developing that idea or challenging that idea that with noble birth comes just nobility in your manners and things. And he says, actually, it's all affected. And if you can develop that, then you can be noble. And, you know, this is the thing with Sir Walter Raleigh. He becomes a big dude, but he came from nothing. And this
Who
is to
Sir
say...
Sir Walter Raleigh?
Sir Walter Raleigh? He was a pirate.
Oh, cool.
He was Elizabeth's right-hand man. He was a pirate, but not a pirate with the Spanish Armada. He, like, went off to America and tried to start a whole colony on his own. He wrote poetry. He had a monopoly on, like, a certain trade. Elizabeth gave him monopoly. He was fighting the Spanish. He was, like, everything.
Right.
I'll send you the dollop episode. Anyway, it was pretty cool. And the point about him is he's the first big example of, a kind of meritocratic rise to power. But the point Spencer is making is he's challenging that idea, and there's this word that Peter keeps using, sprezzatura, which is an Italian word for basically doing something and making it seem like it's spontaneous or it's natural, even though actually it took quite a lot of effort to develop.
Oh, I'm going to drop that in my next music review. Instead of saying, you know, they make it look effortless, I can say
sprezzatura. And that came to mind immediately from this, because it's like, unless you know how best to use such precious gifts, you need a godfather or godmother. And that is kind of what Spencer is saying. He's like, nobody knows how to use these gifts. They're not actually a thing. It's not a gift. And you need someone to teach you, and all of it is affected. And he's challenging that part of society, which is pretty cool.
So
that's what Spencer
wrote. Virtue Megazord.
Yeah, all of them at once.
Them all together.
Oh, God.
And obviously this is interesting because it's saying you need a godmother to show you how to work.
Yeah, it's anything.
Cute. But in connection to the fairy tales, like the idea of the fairy godmother has to guide the...
Yeah, thing. And that works with Spencer because all the knights need a guide.
Right.
Like a particular Guyon in book two, which is the Book of Temperance, he has a palmer, as we talked about last episode, who guides him through everything. So yeah, big Spencer vibes.
Big Spencer vibes. The editor of the Oxford collection, Christopher Betts, however, suggests that prose moral is more of a practical suggestion rather than a comment on the story.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this is actually supporting what
you're
saying.
Yeah.
So he's not going, it's the fairy tale godmother thing. He's saying, no, you need like someone to raise you right, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
Since wealthy and influential friends or relatives were often asked to fulfill the role of the godmother or godfather in the expectation that their sponsorship would be of value to the child in later life. Which seems like a pretty literal and uninspired reading to me, although you've just sort of...
it kind of works.
You've like, supported it.
In some cultures, godparents are, like, really important.
Yeah, I think now that you've said all that, I'm going, well, yes, no, he is right. But I read that and I just went, you're not having a whole lot of fun with the story, though, are you? Like, this story is about raising children right, and that's all it's about. I'm like, yeah, but it's also about the power of imagination.
Well, that's how you raise children right.
What about my dreams, Alice?
Oh, no. No place for those in academia.
Nah, you smashed them with Spencer. But if we're accepting the alignment between godmothers and their authors, then Perrault is perhaps suggesting that people need writers and stories to teach them how to live. This is the more abstract interpretation that I and Pratchett are sort of wanting to apply to it, which I think is anachronistic. But if we're reading Rumpelstiltskin and saying that's a penis, we can read Cinderella and say this is narrative fairy tales. Despite Cinderella's French origins, the Grimms include a version of it in their collection, citing as its source an anonymous woman in the Elizabeth Hospital in Marburg.
That's it?
Yeah. That's this is German because the lady down the shop.
That's Coleridge being like, I dreamt this.
I mean, you probably did dream it, right?
Yeah.
Was on opium. But in the Grimm's version, Cinderella has a golden slipper rather than a glass one, which reminded me of the gold hat in The Wizard of Oz,
the
book version. So I think there's maybe a lineage there. Cinderella also originally wears wooden shoes, so that the shoe is more a symbol of class rather than delicacy.
Isn't that Dutch? Clogs?
Dutch clogs, yeah, maybe.
Huh.
Either way, there are arguments that the slipper was originally a fur slipper.
Oh, no.
And therefore meant to represent a vagina. This is something that's also referenced in The Science of Discworld 2.
No.
But Kevin Paul Smith, who's the guy who had the taxonomy of all the different...
Just jumping in here, because in this next section, I mistakenly credit the criticisms of Balzac to Smith rather than Betts, who's the editor of the Perrault collection. So yeah, when we say Smith, it's Betts, not Smith, until we get to talking about the implications of the mothers compared to witches abroad, and that is actual Smith saying that. Carry on.
He dismisses this explanation, saying that the idea comes from the French writer Honoré de Balzac. I know how to say Balzac, but I just looked at that and went, Horny Balzac. The French writer Horny Balzac, who confuses the word vera for glass and ver, which is an old word for squirrel fur.
Ah, Peter has told me this, yeah.
Right. And Balzac argued that shoes would have been made out of fur rather than glass.
And fur is still a symbol of wealth. It makes sense that it's more delicate, it's hard to come by.
I don't know if that applies to, like, your peasants would wear fur slippers just because they hunt animals and wear their skins, maybe, rather than it being today where you have, hopefully, faux fur, vegetarian propaganda. As a sign of class. I'm not sure about that. But Smith points out that this practical consideration is irrelevant for an already unrealistic story. The point is not that the slipper is practical, it's that it's magic and fits only one foot, and that fur could be stretched, but glass cannot. So it can't be a fur slipper, because then it breaks the story.
Okay.
He also adds that no text containing the alleged spelling of vair, V-A-I-R, has ever been discovered. Nor did Balzac provide any evidence for there being one.
Yeah, Balzac.
So this is more inaccurate psychoanalytic nonsense.
Huh.
In the Grimm's version, the stepsisters also cut off their heels to fit in the shoes and have their eyes pecked out by birds that help Cinderella do her housework.
It's pretty grim.
At Cinderella's wedding. Which, yes, I thought it was pretty brutal. Smith also points out that Cinderella is aided by the spirit of her dead mother in some early versions of the tale, pointing out that Emberella is ultimately aided by her mother, who is still alive and kicking, in the person of Ursula Gogol, more about her next part, and also points out that it is Emberella's dead father, reanimated as a zombie by her mother, who acts to secure Emberella's rightful inheritance. So again, as in Weird Sisters, we end up with someone who is the result of an affair with the king or queen, taking over the kingdom, which is a trope, but also this is a structural similarity of Pratchett's tales. Like, if Witches Abroad is meant to be about subverting or avoiding the same ending over and over again, but Pratchett is doing that by using the same ending that he's used before.
Does he know?
Not sure.
Should we tell him?
Well, yeah, I don't think this is deliberate. I think, again, he's like, this is a subversion of the rightful ruler, the princess marries the king thing, but he's done it in the same way. Which I thought was interesting.
Yeah, no, agreed.
Yeah. So that's Cinderella. There's also the reference to Bluebeard, which is a very significant story, I think, in academic circles, but I don't know if it's really that popular or well-known in general. There's certainly no Disney adaptation of it.
It's because it's so horrifying.
Well, do you want to explain the story, since you specifically read it so you could do so?
Bluebeard's a guy who no one will marry because he has a blue beard. He's a very, very wealthy guy, so it is specifically the blue beard that is turning people off him. He does eventually get a wife somehow, kind of tricks her, and then he goes away for the weekend and he gives her all these keys, and he's like, hey, you can do anything. You can go into this room, you can do that, whatever, but don't use this key to get into this very specific room. And she's like, yeah, sure, honey. And then he leaves. And then she's like, she goes in all the rooms. And then the moment her friends come over, she's like, nah, bye. And she goes in the room she's not meant to. She finds all of these horrifically mutilated bodies and is horrified. So there's blood on the key. She can't get it off. The husband comes home. He's like, you went into my room. I must murder you now. She somehow gets help. And then her brothers burst in. I assume there's some commentary there we can go into. And murder him instead. But he's all like, yeah, you will join them in that room. So that's fun.
The fall, right?
Well, it's insatiable curiosity again.
Yeah, specifically...
I mean, I saw it as fastest because it was like... You were specifically told not to do something and then you went and do it. But yeah, it's also the fall.
I mean, it's God saying...
It's all the same.
You can eat anything in this forest, but not that thing.
Yeah.
And then the woman being punished specifically. Mm-hmm. More on that to come.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so you just summarised the Perrault version of Bluebeard. Some highlights from the Grimm's version, which was included in their original 1812 collection, but later omitted due to its French origins, as much of these stories we're finding out were. There's a stream of blood when she opens the door, which reminded me of The Shining. But also, as you said, the key falls in the blood and it gets stained. Mm-hmm. This is the evidence of her crime, which is Macbeth.
Yep.
Right? She tries to wash the blood off the key. And yeah, Perrault's version that you recited is pretty similar, although the morals he attaches at the end are worth examining. Do you want to read this one, Alice?
No, I'll swallow that. All right. Alright.
Yes, Alice, did you want to read the Perrault's morals for Bluebeard?
Sure. Curiosity is all very well in its way, but satisfy it and you risk much remorse. The feminine sex will deny it, of course, but the pleasure you wanted once taken is lost, and the knowledge you looked for is not worth the cost.
So this is like Curiosity killed the cat who wants to go outside. Sorry, Goose. It's too late. It's 7 o'clock at night. She's not allowed. Which makes sense. But there's nothing this moral about don't murder women and keep your bodies in a secret room.
Thank you.
Which is a bit of an oversight.
Like, who's going to have to say this?
Yeah. Later versions of the tale were often subtitled The Fatal Effects of Curiosity or The Effect of Female Curiosity. So again, this is like very explicitly embedded into the tradition that it's original sin. But Perrault adds that people with sense who use their eyes will not take long to realize that this is a tale of bygone days, and what it tells is now untrue. The modern husband does not ask his wife to undertake a task impossible for her to do, and even when dissatisfied with her, he is quiet as a mouse. What do you make of that, Alice?
I mean, that's worse somehow, and also better, but also worse.
Well, it's one of those, like, progress doesn't equal morality sort of arguments. Yeah. Like, it is better that but we don't murder people in a castle, but it's not. But yes, this isn't the pinnacle of morality, but Perrault is sort of revising this fairy tale.
Yeah.
What we were talking about, where any new version is a revision.
Right.
We're saying this used to be about how men might literally murder their women and keep them in the murder
through castle. The moral at the end.
Yeah.
Yeah, so he's updating the moral to update the fairy tale.
Yeah, he's that's retelling the same story, but he's reinterpreting it. Or he's not even reinterpreting it. I guess he's just acknowledging that we have moved on, but he's not reinterpreting it.
Yeah.
So maybe it's like not a reinterpretation. That's him going, I should rewrite this, but I'm not going to.
I'm going to put it down as not progress. It's like he was like, too hard. I'll just change the moral.
This is true. And yeah, he still maintains the priorities of that first moral about it's a thing about specifically female curiosity being punished. But yeah, I hadn't even heard of this fairy tale until I was talking to Patrick about Angela Carter's The Bloody Chamber, which, as we mentioned last episode, is sort of the canonical feminist fairy tale revision. Have you read this one?
I haven't read it. I know about it, but I haven't read it.
Well, it's not really different story beat wise, except that it's her mother rather than her brothers who save her at the end.
Okay.
Which seems like a very basic feminist revision.
Very.
So I didn't really get it, although Smith does a really good close reading of it in the Postmodern Fairy Tale, explaining a lot of the subtleties, which are really subtle.
Okay.
And that gave me a bit more of an appreciation for it. I won't go into them here, but I do highly recommend looking at that.
The Postmodern Fairy Tale? Okay.
When analysing Carter's Bloody Chamber, Smith observes that Carter's unnamed female protagonist is aware of the Bluebeard story herself, since she makes a reference to clockwork tableau of Bluebeard that you see in glass cases at fairs, and also makes knowing references to the stories of Pandora and Eve.
Okay.
Indeed, before she goes to open the chamber, she reads a whole bunch of books about Pandora, mysterious keys, and reproofs of curiosity, leading Smith to wonder why Carter's protagonist even enters the Bloody Chamber at all if she is aware of these precedents and already knows the story of Bluebeard herself.
Takes us back to the first moral of, like, you need to be trained.
That, yeah, women are insatiable.
Mm.
But Maria Tata, who counted all the words in the Grimm stories that we were talking about last episode, argues that the protagonist has no choice. Since as soon as we learn about the dire consequences that will attend the mere touching of a spindle, we know that Briar Rose will somehow search out and find the only spindle left in her father's kingdom. This is narrative causality. Her argument is that in Carter's version, the lady, even though she knows the morals, is trapped within this formula.
Is that some de Beauvoir shit?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Look at me learning.
Yeah, this is doing the Pratchett thing, but again, by implication.
Mm.
The idea that, well, she knows all this, but she's still forced to because that's the way stories repeat.
Yeah.
Or it's a patriarchal imposition.
Yeah, the latter.
Yes. However, Smith argues that if we take a closer look at Poirot's Bluebeard, we begin to see that the heroine is not punished for her curiosity. He points out that even in that version, through her husband's death, Poirot's protagonist escapes the fate of her predecessors, because she's like his, what, fifth or sixth wife or something. This has happened before. So this is the story not about the woman who was killed for her curiosity, but the woman who avoided being killed and punished for her curiosity, and that she actually inherits the castle at the end of the story.
So female empowerment? Get your brothers to beat up the guy who was mean to you?
Yeah, man.
Okay.
So Warner concurs, claiming that Bluebeard is a version of the Fall where Eve gets away with it, with Carter's version accentuating the complicity between Poirot and his heroine and reclaiming the feminist nature of the tale. Interestingly, there is a similar story in the Grimm's first collection called The Castle of Murder! Which was later omitted due to its Dutch origins and similarity to Bluebeard. It's essentially the same story.
Wait. So the Grimms were only using German?
Oh, that was the idea. It was meant to be a collection of German fairy tales.
Okay, yeah. Right.
In that story, though, in the Castle of Murder, the door isn't forbidden. It is instead, though, guarded by an old woman who was scraping intestines outside the door. These are implied to be human intestines.
Oh.
She's, cooking his victims, because that's the other thing. He's an ogre. He's a cannibal, which all fairy tale villains are, apparently. But this woman ends up helping the girl escape and then disguises herself and then exposes Bluebeard by telling his story at a feast.
Right. Storytelling.
Mm. But also, was the feminist subversion therefore already built in to the story and then written out by Poirot and other that revisions? Before.
Yeah, it is showing that the man is the bad guy here.
Yeah, and then gets replaced by Carter and other personalist revisers later. So it's cyclical, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, this shows how, though persistent, the shapes of stories do change. So, last episode, we spent ages analysing Sleeping Beauty and The Wizard of Oz, despite the relatively slight references to the Witches Abroad. And this time we're going to do that with The Frog Prince, which in the Grimm's collection is actually called The Frog King, or Iron Heinrich.
What's that mean?
So, Heinrich is the name of the king's servant who got so sad when the king disappeared because he loved the king so much.
Oh, that's right.
With the iron bands around his heart.
Yeah.
And then when the king returns, the bands burst because of his love for the king.
I did read this one. That's some gay subtext, yeah?
I don't know.
Okay.
I've never thought about it.
I mean,
I think it's more just saying you should like your king. I'm assuming people know the story of the Frog Prince, but so the princess, or is she just a wizard? She's a princess, and she's got a favorite ball, and it rolls into the swamp, and then she goes, and there's a frog near the thing, and says, "I'll get your ball if you give me a kiss," and then she kisses and turns into a frog. That's how we understand the story.
Yep.
That's not what happens in the Grimm's version. In the Grimm's version, she promises the frog a kiss, but she doesn't give it to him.
Mm-hmm.
And the king demands that his daughter should keep her promise. Like, the story is all about, you said you were going to give this guy this thing, and you're lying, and you're a bad princess.
Reciprocal altruism.
Yeah, and the frog's, like, following around. He's just a frog still.
Yep.
But he's, like, he's
a talking frog. The king doesn't object to that.
No. Again, it's... Yeah, so the frog's hanging out with the princess, going, "Hey, you promised me a kiss."
Mm-hmm.
Like, or maybe it's just marriage, but, you know. sex stuff.
Yeah, he's like, you promised that you would take me with you and do all this stuff. I want to eat at your table and sleep in your bed. But yeah, the implication is that.
Well, I think it's like it's marriage.
Yeah.
And she ends up getting so mad at him that she throws him against the wall. And that's when he turns back into the prince.
Frog murder turns into prince.
I guess the implication there is rather than if you kiss something ugly, it becomes the prince. It's that, like, if the moral's meant to be about her breaking her promise and condemning the princess's behaviour, the idea that when she finally threw him away, it was revealed that he was what she wanted sort of thing.
Right.
Yeah, so the moral there is more about keeping promises and maybe not judging people by their appearance rather than true love.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also forcing the princess into a non-consensual cross-species sexual relationship. So
you said it.
Not great, I did. In that version, the Grimm's one, the king is turned into a frog by a wicked witch. But that's not why it's interesting. It's interesting because of all the connections between Witches Abroad and the 2009 Disney animated film The Princess and the Frog.
And Witches Abroad came before.
Oh, well before.
Yeah.
Witches Abroad's in, 1991 and that's 2009. And I still don't think it exists, despite having actually seen it now.
What?
So just for ages, when you saw the catalogue of like Disney movies, I'd be like, what the fuck is that one? I've never seen this film.
That's one of my favourites.
It's probably in the gap where I become, old, I'm aged out of Disney. But 2009, I'm 19, so I'm well out of the target market.
Okay.
But I also had younger sisters that I would take to the movies and I'd take them to see Brave and all the kids' films and stuff.
Brave's so good.
And I just missed that one. And then I'd look at it and I'd be like, what is this fucking movie that I've never heard of? Like, even if you haven't seen the movies, you see like Disney princess shit everywhere. And I'd never seen anything from it.
Okay.
Anyway, I finally watched it in preparation for this podcast.
And?
Yeah, it's fine.
Alright.
Like mid-tier Disney at best.
She has a dream.
We'll get to
yeah, there's some neoliberalist bullshit in there, but yeah.
but you like this movie. I've brought it up before and you really
like it. This one, Brave and Tangled are probably my favourites.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, which Brave is my favourite. Yeah. I really liked Brave, mostly because, werebears.
Yeah. But Mom, it's just my boy.
So there's lots of obvious connections, right? Both are set in New Orleans or a New Orleans-esque type of place.
Yep.
Jenny was based on New Orleans. Pratchett's explicitly said that, as we will discuss later. And then you've got, there's Voodoo, and Baron Saturday is the main antagonist in the movie. But that movie is actually based on another postmodern fairy tale revision, which is the 2002 children's novel The Frog Princess by E.D. Baker.
Okay.
Now, if you want to hear more about that, you can go and listen to the Princess and the Frog episodes of the Disney Story Origins podcast that we talked about. The story in that book is quite different from the movie. Apparently, it's just like an adaptation in name only.
Mm-hmm.
That book is not set in New Orleans. It's just set in a generic European fantasy world.
Okay.
Nor is there any voodoo, which makes the resemblance to Witches Abroad sort of even more curious. So I don't know how they both get to New Orleans voodoo from fairy tale revision.
Mm.
Like, is it just that frogs equal swamps and swamps are in New Orleans?
I never thought of that. I think it's linked to what you're about to talk about a little bit. Okay. Go on. Yeah.
Well, I think this is a bit of a tangent, but I do want to address some of the things that the presenter of the Disney Story Origins podcast, Paul J. Hale, says on these episodes. So he points out that the film version is very specifically dated to the era of World War I through references made in the film to Woodrow Wilson, who was the president of the United States during the war.
Yep.
And he also points out that the film is anachronistic since there is no depiction of black segregation.
Yep.
Which is particularly interesting since the film features the first and only black Disney princess.
Mm-hmm.
And in the film, she loses her father in the war.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as Hale points out, this is kind of bullshit since there was like segregation that existed in the army as well. And there was a whole thing about African Americans serving in World War I.
Yep.
But he defends this decision to, not include that in the film, saying that the film is meant to represent fantasy and a better version of history for children to aspire to. It's a movie about frogs and princesses and chasing your dreams, which I think would be fine. If Disney had decided to depict a nebulous, imaginary moment in history, right? This is just old time in New Orleans. But the fact that they've specifically dated it to Woodrow Wilson and World War I, I don't know why they've done that. But then if you're going to put that in there, then you're presenting a version of the past that's sort of, I want to say whitewashing, but obviously that would
but
be...
But it is.
Well, yeah, I guess that would be appropriate.
And the bit that particularly rankles with that is Tiana's annoying friend, the one in all the frilly dresses, her father is called Big Daddy.
Yep.
And that's a name often associated with, like, sugar plantation tycoons.
Oh, okay, I didn't know that.
So you don't like Tennessee Williams. I mean, who does?
I don't really know Tennessee Williams.
Oh, a Streetcar Named Desire?
Yeah, I don't know of Tennessee Williams. Like,
Cat in a Hot Tin Roof. Again, Big Daddy is an interesting antagonist slash protagonist in it, and Big Daddy, like, he is a tycoon of a sugar plantation. Yeah, so
yeah,
it's even more on the nose for me through that. And Disney's, like, saying, oh, we're doing commentary on it, but they're not. It's just children have to go up and learn the history on their own to actually recognize the problems. Yeah. Otherwise, they just end up thinking history was all fine and dandy.
Yeah, rather than giving them sort of an idealized thing to aspire to, it's giving them an idealized past to paint over.
Exactly.
The past.
I mean, especially, even Pocahontas at least shows racism.
Right.
Yeah.
Especially when the messages of the Frog Princess film is all about how you just need to work hard to achieve your dreams.
Yeah.
Right? She's working the whole movie to open her own restaurant, but I don't think that's going to happen while segregation is a thing. Like, she's not allowed to own a restaurant in the same areas with the white customers and the wealthy white customers. Like, this isn't happening, so no matter how hard she works. So, yeah.
Yeah.
But this is an example, this is to bring it back to, which is abroad, is this is an example of stories reshaping history.
Mm-hmm.
So children who grow up watching this film and don't question it grow up with the idea that everything was hunky-dory for African-Americans in the 1920s and that they should simply pull themselves up by their bootstraps.
Neoliberalism!
Yeah. I'm sort of cautious here to clarify that I'm not criticizing Hale.
No.
Who, in the most recent episode he uploaded, he's pretty distressing. He sort of describes a lot of fan mail, or not fan mail, that he's gotten, saying that he gets called a racist and things like that. I don't think he's a racist, right? We're not saying that, but there is quite a bit of political correctness gone mad in some of his delivery that I wish he'd toned down.
Yeah.
But I'm not criticizing him. I'm criticizing what Disney's doing here.
Yeah.
But what I think Hale is overlooking is how stories shape people's perceptions of the world, regardless of the reality or empirical facts, which is precisely what Pratchett is pointing at in which is the book.
I mean, that's genuine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's interesting that this film that represents or reflects, to use the mirror analogy, which is abroad so much, is sort of reiterating the thing that Pratchett is specifically rallying against in Witches Abroad. Just to put a pin on that thought.
Oh!
Yeah, go on.
So, I went looking for something on Patrick's blog the other day. And I saw he put up
17th century dildo?
No.
Okay.
It was something else. It was Satan-related.
Okay.
And then I saw it about the time that I asked him for bookshop recommendations for Sydney. He'd then obviously done a real think about it and written a post. And I was like, oh, cute. And then a bunch of other posts. And he has done a whole post about the phrase, put a pin in it. And basically proven that the phrase is actually to do with women reading, because they would reach for a sewing pin, which in those days was sort of long wooden things, and then pop it in as a bookmark. And that's how he puts a pin in it. And he, like really methodically works through it. He's like, it's not this, and the Oxford Dictionary is wrong, everyone's wrong, it's this. I figured it out, everyone sit down, blog post over. And I'm like...
So that's some good shit.
That's,
There's specific fairy tales sort of dealt with, a bit on Snow White coming up. But now I want to zoom out a bit and talk about Disney himself, because
we Disney himself?
Disney himself, okay. Disney themselves, the Disney Corporation.
Evil or not?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, way evil.
Yeah, kind of Nazi.
They're Lilith. They're Nazi Lilith.
They're Lilith.
Yeah,
Hang on.
Yep.
I only need 3 business days.
Because Genoa is not just New Orleans, it's Disneyland.
Mm-hmm.
Or more specifically, it is Disney World. So Pratchett has said, we'll discuss this a bit more later, that Genoa is inspired by Disneyland and New Orleans. It's a conflation of those two places.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, we've just spent a lot of time talking about these fairy tales, talking about the Disney adaptations, the Disney princess and things, because the shapes of these stories that we are most familiar with these days come from the popular animated Disney films of the mid and late 20th centuries and beyond now, I guess. But the 21st century ones, like Tangled that we were talking about, and even Frozen.
Oh, Frozen.
Are more subversive.
Yeah.
Whereas it's the sort of mid-20th century stuff that is these traditional...
Conservative
patriarchal fairy tale values we're looking at. And as Smith points out, these are as much revisions of preceding fairy tales as the later postmodern ones.
Mm.
And you start to see what we consider their traditional values being subverted in the later Disney Renaissance films of the 1990s, which is something De Rosario has written about, pointing out how in the 90s films, the princesses become more independent, more capable, and more athletic as well.
Mm-hmm.
Like you have Jasmine pole vaulting over things. As De Rosario observes, the princess who emerges from this kingdom is not the same princess who emerged from the tales of Perrault or the Brothers Grimm or from the folklore of the past at all. She characterizes the classic Disney princesses, such as Snow White and Cinderella, who I realize, like, don't have names, which is something anytime you do any feminist analysis of anything, the first thing people point out is the women don't have names. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so she characterizes these classic Disney princesses as embodiments of Hollywood starlets and the early 20th century middle class. Later, however, in the Disney Renaissance films of the late 1980s and 1990s, which came out approximately 2 decades after the death of Walt Disney himself, when the studio came under the control of a management group led by Michael Eisner, the Disney princesses of the Disney Renaissance became more independent and capable, moving with the grace of sportswomen rather than domesticated servants.
They had to fumigate the Disney out of everything.
But again, like, to me, is this just fitting female figures in traditionally male roles?
It's not really bringing together the two, is it?
They're being capable, but they're just filling in the roles of what the men would usually do.
And they have to hide some of their capabilities, Jasmine in particular?
Yeah, I mean, the possible counter-example of this is Belle from Beauty and the Beast, who seems a bit more balanced. She's a bit more, like, self-determined.
She reads!
Yeah, and she's the protagonist rather than the... I guess Pocahontas is a protagonist as well. But, like, Mulan, which I have a lot of problems with that movie. That movie's bad,
actually. Where to begin?
But she is literally taking on a man's role. That is the point of that movie. And the big song for her is, "We'll make a man out of you," right? But also, all these Disney movies, with the exception of Mulan, are also my favourite Disney movies because I grew up in the 90s and I'm a dude. So I'm like, fuck yeah, Lion King, let's go.
Yeah.
Is this a good time for us to sort of camp out on Disney films for a bit? Do you have anything to say about Disney films?
I don't like the earlier ones. It's not until the 1990s, 2000s I like. I only liked Beauty and the Beast because she had the library, and I think that's every academic I met. It's like, oh yeah, Belle, she reads. I could never get behind the people who were like, oh, but the Beast is sexy though. Still don't understand that. Gaston is the worst.
Yeah, Gaston fucking sucks. But he's meant to suck in those movies, whereas he would have been the hero of Sleeping Beauty.
Exactly.
Right?
I do think, though, that some people get behind Gaston. Like, I met some dudes at school who were like, oh, but Gaston's pretty cool, though.
Teenage boys are not good moral compasses.
I know, but that's hard when you're a teenage girl and you're like, what?
True.
And I mean, Shrek.
It's not a Disney film.
But it's a fairy tale.
I mean, of these movies, the one we're overlooking that I know you like is Hercules.
Oh, I love Hercules. Yeah, Hercules, I know you came to not like it.
I did not like it. I recently rewatched it because we were talking about how much we loved Hercules, and then I went rewatch it. It wasn't as good as I remembered. There's a lot of downtime. Essentially, when I come away from it was, it's only great when Hades is on screen.
Oh, yeah, I know. But there's also, like, so much cool meta.
Well,
like,
that's what...
All the illusions.
It's definitely the most subversive and revisionist in the postmodern sense of these 90s films.
Well, it's all propaganda. We talked about this. Yeah. You were like, it's Zeus propaganda. Yeah. They rewrite it. They change it around.
They say Zeus was defeated the Titans or something, but Zeus overthrew the Titans.
And they make Zeus look like a good guy throughout the film.
Ah,
like,
Zeus fucking sucks.
Zeus sucks. and Hercules actually kind of sucks too.
And I do think it's good. I'd also come off rewatching Beauty and the Beast, and the animation of Hercules is, it's not up to the same level. It's not the A-tier studio.
No. But it's also some of the best music, sorry.
That's true. I think it has the best soundtrack.
Yeah.
Easily.
Yeah. There is a guy on Twitter, I can send you the thing, maybe you can put it in, who does these great breakdowns of, like, specific little details that Disney have included in that, which have a lot of Greek mythology.
You did send me these.
They're very cool.
The only thing I remembered was learning that Meg is based on the shape of pots, and then questioning a lot of how I feel about pots. But the other thing about these films is we get this thread of female empowerment, but the writers and directors of these films are all dudes. Is Frozen? I don't know. I can't make a statement about
it. Oh, let me look it up. It was Jennifer Lee, so that's a woman. Yeah. And Chris Buck.
Well, they rewrote it to be two women so they could have the duet of Let It Go.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Listen to the Disney Princess Death Battle.
Have been recommending that to people.
Have you actually listened to it?
No, but I know some people who are really keen on that.
They don't like Brave, though, so yeah.
What?
As Joe Rosario observes, the title of Disney Princess became increasingly democratic during the second half of the 20th century, even being extended to encompass non-human animals in films like Lady and the Tramp, The Aristocats, and The Lion King.
1955.
For the Lady and the Tramp.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, that sort of undoes her argument a bit that it's that old.
Yeah.
Although Lady isn't really, I don't know if she counts as a princess if we want to get technical, whereas Nala and the Lion King is a princess.
Did we land on that, did we? Well, I thought we landed on she didn't.
The people on the Disney podcast didn't include it because they were just doing humans.
Yeah. We discussed it. I thought she was.
Yeah, we discussed it, but the argument wasn't whether she was a princess. I agree, Nala is definitively a princess, right? The argument was whether she beats human people in a
desert. Oh, that was the argument, was it? Okay.
Yeah, you were saying lion beats human, but I was pointing out that Gaston has a sword and a gun.
I thought it was the princess versus princess, though.
Oh, yeah, that might have been Scar.
Oh.
Yeah, I think you were on the side lion beats human, and I was on the side human beats lion, because all the Disney princesses are armed / magical.
But she's a lion.
I mean, not.
There we are.
So, yeah, this, like, points out our thing. Nala defeats the old Disney princesses.
Yeah.
She mauls Snow White. There's the seven dwarves around.
Because she's just flopping about. And seven dwarves, they're...
Yeah. Cinderella, gone. Yeah. Sleeping Beauty, she's just lying there for the taking.
Yeah.
But you get Nala up against Jasmine or Mulan, they're going to fuck a bitch up.
I need to see it.
During this period, they also ceased being orphans and became, quote, Daddy's little girl.
Mm.
So, for example, as Dorozario points out, Ariel is the favourite daughter of King Triton, whereas Jasmine and Pocahontas are beloved only children.
That's what I'd forgotten about, the Little Mermaid, yeah.
See, Nala's got to, like, swim to get to her. She'll just drown.
Oh, I wasn't even there yet. I was just thinking about...
Although, actually, they do stipulate in the Disney Death Battle podcast that they take the princesses as they are at the end of the film.
Well, that's so dumb.
What's her name? Well, that their argument is that they've gone through their full arc. That's meant to be their final...
So she's a human. She's just a human.
She's human. So, yeah, I think...
So there's nothing there.
We can say Nala defeats Ariel.
Yeah.
Yeah. However, as Dorozario also observes, not one of Disney's princesses has a mother or a brother still.
Nala has a mum.
No, she doesn't. Who's Nala's mum?
One of the lions. She's there. She's like, you can't go with Simba. And she, like, grabs her with
him. Is Nala a princess then? Or she... No, she becomes a princess by marriage.
By marrying Simba.
So she's dead by then because all the lions get killed.
Yeah.
But the point here is that mothers are still demonized, so they've become...
Rapunzel, she is, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, Rapunzel's kind of the reversion of the later subversive one, even though it's maybe the most feministly subversive, it's still modeled on these old fairy tales, so it's carrying through some of those implications. I guess the one Disney film that goes, like, way in on the mother stuff is Brave, but even then she gets turned into a bear and raised by her father through the whole movie.
And Bambi, like, Bambi the mother gets killed.
Yeah.
I know it's not a Disney princess thing, but goddamn.
That's just stories about orphans.
Did that traumatize you?
I never really watched Bambi, probably because when I was a vegetarian, I was like, don't watch this. But
yeah, I watched it once and that was enough.
Yeah, it's not one that was really in my rotation. I mean, I was very... The 90s stuff was what I watched because I was born in 1990. That's our opinions about Disney, but what did the experts say, Alice?
God.
So Jack Sipes, who, as we mentioned in part one, is the academic authority when it comes to fairy tale revisions, argues in the chapter Breaking the Disney Spell from his 1994 book Fairy Tale as Myth, Myth as Fairy Tale, that the great magic of the Disney spell is that he animated the fairy tale only to transfix audiences and divert their potential utopian dreams and hopes through the false promises of the images he cast upon the screen.
Ooh.
Zipes further observes how Disney uses his specifically American grit and ingenuity to appropriate European fairy tales. So that's another thing. We're getting Americanized versions of all these traditionally
French. And the French American dream is embedded in all of them.
Right. Yeah. This is the opposite of Oz.
Oh, no.
But Zipes says that although the plots varied and the themes and characters are altered, his Americanized fairy tales only reinforce a patriarchal symbolic order based on rigid notations of sexuality and gender. Nothing new here, just this is what the big guy is saying.
The big guy. Zipes.
Well, and he does not like Disney. So in his chapter, Walt Disney's Civilizing Mission, in his 1983 book, Fairy Tales and the Art of Subversion, Zipes further argues that Disney's fairy tale revolution was a major regression and caused many of the liberating aspects of the fairy tale to be tamed and turned in against themselves, stating that the Disney civilizing process leads to the degeneration of utopia. So yeah, literally the
end. Yes. Dystopia.
Oh, I could go on a rant about how dystopia is not the opposite of utopia. They're actually on the same side.
Sorry. And then the anti-anti-utopias. I was trying to trigger him, and it worked.
And then you get the anti-anti-utopias.
It really worked.
Anti-anti-anti-utopias, but no one knows what one of those is.
Mission accomplished.
Thank you. You hit me with the Manchurian candidate code.
I broke him.
She said anti-anti-utopia. No, I did. Okay. Although Zipes acknowledges that since the cinematic medium is a popular form of expression and is accessible to a larger public, Disney actually also returns the fairy tale to a broader audience than the majority of people. But still, he characterizes Disney films as, an attack on the literary tradition of the fairy tale, which robs the literary tale of its voice and changes its form and meaning. As Zipes observes, Disney's emphasis is on purification, preparing oneself to become chosen and a member of the elite. And he says that this American cleansing process, which is based on meritocracy, replaces the old schemata of the European fairy tale, while at the same time restoring notions of hierarchy and elitism, reinforcing redundant behavior and leading to a static dystopian vision of the world.
Like, they're just appropriating it all and forcing it through, like, a vortex of American values.
So Zipes describes Disney's dystopian cleansing process in the following manner. He says that in Disney's films, the technology, technique, artistic appeal takes precedent over the stories themselves, so that people are sort of carried away by the spectacle rather than engaging with the narrative and reflecting on its messages. And that although in Disney films these traditional fairy tale characters are fleshed out to become more realistic and more fuller characters, they still remain one-dimensional stereotypes. And then he says these seductive, stereotypical images are exported through movie screens to colonize other natural audiences insofar as the ideas and types are portrayed as models of behavior to be emulated. Essentially, it's not just contained to America. This is, like, worldwide influence.
And they have Americanized the world.
Right. And now Disney...
Everyone can have the American dream. You get the American dream. You get the American dream.
Wow. I mean, the fact that you're explaining that using...
Through Oprah. Is, yeah. Pretty... No, I knew what I was doing.
Okay. More pertinent to Witches Abroad, however, is that Zipes also says that what makes Disney's artistry appalling,
ooh,
no matter how delightful some of these characters and scenes are, is the repetition of a pattern typical of Hollywood and Broadway musicals, which repeat the same romantic endings. Pointing out that from Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs onwards up through Beauty and the Beast, writers and directors in Disney studios have all operated within the same formula. So, as we discussed before, things sort of change in the 90s, but it's not the details of these stories, it's the structure of them that is reinforcing the behaviour, which is what Pratchett's rallying against.
Yep.
In Witches Abroad. Do Rosario addresses Zipes' criticisms in her 2004 article, The Princess and the Magic Kingdom. She argues that Walt Disney is perhaps more than any other fairy tale teller, with the exception of Mother Goose, portrayed as a fairy tale figure himself. And that instead of being portrayed as a storyteller, he is instead portrayed as a prince and a king of his own magic kingdom, right? His Lilith.
That checks out.
Yeah. Which itself is an international conglomerate whose corporate logo is a castle.
Yeah, that's... I was thinking that immediately. Right. I'm like, oh yeah, he's a king prince corporation. Oh no.
As Zipes observes, Snow White is another story that was made even more conservative and patriarchal by Disney. In the Grimm's version of Snow White, the prince is absent until the end of the story, and it's not his kiss that revives Snow White, but the dwarves accidentally jolting the piece of poison an apple from her throat when they're carrying her coffin. They sort of stumble and it like pops out of her mouth. Oh, she was alive all along. So again, this idea of true love's first kiss is something that's installed later. However, Disney's version, which is Disney's first major success and kicks off the whole Disney princess thing, begins with the prince singing a song of devotion to Snow White, and it's his kiss that turns out to be the only antidote to the queen's poison, come its conclusion. Disney's reinforcement and extension of the Grimm's patriarchal ideology leads Zipes to declare him their perfect disciple, even suggesting that Disney figures himself as the prince in his version of Snow White lurking in the background, while the disenfranchised dwarf do all the work and then swooping in to take the credit at the end.
Okay, I follow Zipes, but also that's some gubbin and gubar crap.
That's some gubbin and gubar bullshit.
Yeah.
We'll clarify that in part three.
Oh, hang on for that, guys.
So, of course, Lilith's mirrors are an allusion to the evil queen in Snow White, who asks her, mirror, mirror on the wall, who's the fairest of them all?
Me.
It's Alice, apparently. Everyone shut it down. Ironically, compared to Witches Abroad, where mirrors can only create false imitations, the queen in the Grimm's version of Snow White is made content because she knew the mirror always told the truth. In the Grimm's version, she's also another ogre or cannibal who is described as wicked and eats what she thinks are Snow White's liver and lungs brought back by the huntsman.
Oh, God.
She's also the one who is forced to wear the heated iron slippers and dance at Snow White's wedding until she dies at the end.
Mm.
So that's where we get Lily's reference to putting on the red hot shoes and dancing the night away in Witches Abroad, and the Grimm fairy tale, How the Wicked Queen Danced in Red Hot Shoes in Thief of Time. There's a bit of tension in Witches Abroad, however, because Lily resents witches being made to dance to death while everyone lives happily ever after, which is fair enough, right? I'm on Team Lily at this point. But then she goes about it by enforcing or reinforcing the kind of stories whose narrative causality causes witches to be treated like this in the first place. So
yeah.
I'm not really sure what Lily's motivation is. And I'm sure
I think it's just Pratchett being like, haha, let me throw a match on this.
Okay.
And just implodes the idea by turning it back on itself. Like, you can't just keep on demonizing witches just because, like, they're women and they have this role. He's like, they're people too.
But, yeah, it doesn't quite make sense to me logically. I think she wants control,
mm-hmm.
but she doesn't like the way stories portray witches, so she's making the world act like a story that demonizes witches. I'm not quite sure how that works. Writing in the 2006 second edition of Fairy Tales and the Art of Subversion, Zipes hopes that films such as the Shrek series and the popular Studio Ghibli film Spirited Away and Howl's Moving Castle meant that fairy tales would again be used to question the denigration of utopia. However, he cautioned that the establishment of more open-ended type of utopian fairy tale films in America would depend not so much on changes in the culture and industry, but more on real social changes in the ideological bent of the American people and how they try to impose their values of democracy on other countries in the world.
I mean, yeah, but...
Yeah, he's writing this in 2006, and sorry to say, but this did not happen.
Did not happen.
Did not happen. No, not only not did yet. America not become...
a utopia.
Well, not a utopia, but became more conservative, more imperialistic, but Frozen happened. And sort of all that progress gone. Yeah. Disney princesses are back in.
Yeah.
And they're slightly subversive compared to earlier Disney princesses. But
this is not great.
Yeah, this didn't happen. I mean, yeah, you do have Frozen as a story about two sisters rather than...
I mean, it passes the Bechdel test, but that's about it.
Yeah.
Moana?
I don't like Moana just because I think The Rock fucking sucks in that movie.
Lin-Manuel Miranda did the music for it.
Well, because the next thing I was going to say is I fucking hate the music in that film.
Oh, really?
I tried to watch it on a plane. Oh, that back. No, I switched it off because I just hated the music and I hated The Rock singing and I did not like it.
Okay. I didn't like the crab, bad guy crab I couldn't get behind. She is perhaps a little bit more subversive.
Well, the Disney Princess Death Battle, people lose their mind over her.
Oh, I forgot, of course. Yeah. They love Moana. I remember you telling
me. Didn't speak to me.
No, I can see that one is a bit more subversive than what I'm saying, thinking about it, but needs a rewatch. It is her being very independent, her using her femininity.
The other thing you hear here, apart from like sort of the Disney princess renaissance, is that these postmodern subversions, like Shrek and things, get sterilized. Shrek becomes a meme. It becomes this endless series of sequels that no one cares about. But also you get shit like Despicable Me and the Minions, where everything becomes, a sterilized postmodern response where that just becomes the conservative stereotype itself.
I think Shrek did have meaning, but it becomes...
When even Howl's Moving Castle itself is, a sterilized version of that fairy tale. Have you read...
Dinah Wynne Jones? Yeah. When I was very young.
I don't love the Howl's Moving Castle movie. I think that is one that... Yeah, it's way too long, and I think it perhaps wows with spectacle rather than fully-fledged characters. But, I mean, it's completely rewritten to be an analogy for the Japanese wars, but... In the book, like, it's dark at the end. They, like, rip people's heads off and there's...
I like Howl's Moving Castle. I enjoy watching it. But Howl himself is such a shit.
Is he Byronic?
Yeah, he's Byronic. Yeah. And that's why people like him. And I get annoyed by this.
I do think, in retrospect, you're right about Greebo. Greebo is not Byronic.
Oh, my God, thank you.
Because he's not sulky enough.
Okay. All right.
That's what I'm saying.
He's not tortured. Like, he's missing that aspect.
No, you're right. Conversely, Del Rosario points out that in 1959, Sleeping Beauty... The three fairy godmothers give up their magic wands for housework, and that these three tiny, ugly fairies are the actual rescuers of the princess, simply working through the prince, who they rescue from Maleficent's dungeon. Which does remind me of Weird Sisters a bit. But the point Del Rosario is making here is that although Sleeping Beauty isn't the agent of change or action in the film, it is still the elderly witches, the three the fairies, that who they rescue the prince before he rescues Sleeping Beauty.
Women do all the work.
So even though Sleeping Beauty seems like the most conservative Disney film, it is sort of the closest to Pratchett's Weird Sisters subversion.
Okay, I follow you.
Yeah, something going on there. So I want to finish part two by talking a bit about Disneyland.
Have you been?
No.
I've been to the Paris one. It was pretty crap.
Right.
I don't like humans, so.
I mean, I like roller coasters. They have roller coasters there? Or is it just
I was
like
so terrified by all the humans. It was a traumatic experience.
All right.
Yeah.
But no, I haven't been. So, according to correspondence with the L-Space annotators, Pratchett envisioned Genua as New Orleans with a magic kingdom grafted on top of it, which he came up while driving from Orlando, Florida, where Disney World is, to New Orleans, noticing that in one place, you go there and fun is manufactured and presented to you, while in the other, you just eat and drink and have a lot of fun happens. More genuine, so to speak. Yeah. Now, this is something that the French philosopher Jean Baudrillard also noticed when defining the central postmodern concept of the simulacra, which we've brought up almost every episode, I think. So, the way he explains, and not very clearly at all. We spent days of me deciphering this to try and come up with a clear explanation of a simulacrum. We'll see if I've succeeded. So according to Baudrillard, a simulacrum is a simulation or signifier of something for which there is no longer an original. It's a copy of something that's become its own thing.
Yep.
And replace the original. This is something that Philip K. Dick talks about a lot. I mean, he has a book called The Simulacra, but simulacras in his books are the robots. They are the androids of Blade Runner. They're robots that, instead of being copies of people, have become people themselves.
I'm following, actually. Right. I think this is the most I've understood it.
Okay.
At all in our friendship.
So Baudrillard says this is the end result of a cultural process or procession through four orders of simulation, which he explains using Voorhees' 1946 story on exactitude in science, which is the story of the map that becomes the territory.
Right.
And Baudrillard begins his definition of the simulacra saying, do you want to read this one?
If once we were able to view the Voorhees story in which the cartographers of the Empire draw up a map so detailed that it ends up covering the territory exactly as the most beautiful allegory of simulation, this fable has now come full circle for us and possesses nothing but the discrete charm of second-order simulacra. Today, abstraction is no longer that of a map, the double, the mirror, or the concept. Simulation is no longer that of a territory, a referential being, or a substance. It is the generation by models of a real without origin or reality, a hyper-real. The territory is no longer precedes the map, nor does it survive it. It is nevertheless the map that precedes the territory. And if one must return to the fable, today it is the territory whose shreds slowly rot across the extent of the map.
This is literally the first paragraph of Baudrillard's explanation of the simulacra. This is as good as it gets. This is as clear. And of course, this is translated
from French. Yours was clearer. Wow. Yeah.
I've tried to sort of break this down. So the first order of simulation is a simple map.
Yep. All right?
It's a representation of something that already exists.
The thing? Yep.
All right. In the second order, the map and the territory are indistinguishable. It's mm-hmm. a perfect representation, capable of replacing the real thing, but still existing alongside it. So mm-hmm. this is the Voorhees story where the map is so exact that you lay it on top of the territory and you can't tell if there's a map.
I follow you this far.
Right. It's also like if you make a perfect copy of something, like, I guess, art.
So if I cloned you.
If you clone me, but I'm still here, right?
Yeah.
So there's now two of me, but you can't tell which
is
one
which.
Is which.
There's no original.
One is a copy, one is the original.
Gotcha.
Right? Now, in the third order, which is the order of the hyperreal that defines postmodernism, that Baudrillard's talking about here, the territory is replaced by the map, which also masks or hides its absence.
So if your clone killed you.
Yeah, and just went about living my life, and you didn't know that I was dead, you just thought, it's still Josh, but it's not, it's something else that you can't tell apart. So in the Voorhees story, this is the idea that you've covered the territory with the map, and then everyone just goes about walking on the map because it's effectively the same. But then you lift up the map and the land underneath has disappeared.
And that's terrifying because the point is that you don't know.
Yes.
You can't tell.
You don't know, you can't tell. But the point is that real and simulation become blurred, and we sort of see this like more now. We're in, I don't know if we will ever be in post-postmodernism, but he's writing this in, I think it's the 70s, mm-hmm. he's writing this. We're well beyond that, right? Like, the internet's not even a thing. You think about the internet and social media.
Memes, yeah. Oh, my God.
And even, like, Second Life and things where, you have people going by their screen name and stuff. Like, what is their real identity? It's sort of this idea that...
And because everything is manufactured, what's real?
But things like where you have, like, Twitter bots and things where they feed them data and then they can, reproduce, like, an AC/DC song or something just from data gathered from, and then they spit out a song that may as well be an AC/DC song.
So, if you put a bunch of flaccid dicks in a room and they wrote Hamlet on typewriters, that would be a simulacra of Hamlet.
That would be a second-order simulacra of Hamlet, because it's an effective...
Which is as far as I follow this so far.
For that to be a third-order postmodern hyperreal simulacra, I think you would have to replace Shakespeare with a giant flaccid dick.
Okay, I'm pretty sure that's what it is.
I think. So, Baudrillard's writing this in the 70s where this was just an idea, sort of a thought experiment. I think we're past it. Like, we've been through postmodernism. And if we're not out the other side of it, like...
I mean, where are we? Post-truth?
Post-truth is the idea of simulacra. What's real? Fake news.
Fuck! Yeah.
So we've been living with this. So I reckon we're between 3 and 4 at this stage. Now, the fourth and final level, there is no real. Everything is simulation.
We're kind of there sometimes.
We have ourselves and we have our online social media, but what if just there were no real people and there was just a bunch of social media?
We're not far away from there, are we?
I guess maybe to go a step further, what if there were no people and somehow social media was just this perpetuating thing, like the thing where you feed the AC/DC lyrics and it runs an AC/DC song?
Brain in the vat. But
even if you get rid of the brain in the vat.
It's just a vat.
Do you know the Chinese room experiment?
No.
So this is a philosophical thought experiment to sort of try and explain the difference between consciousness and roboticism.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea of the Chinese room is you have a Chinese speaker in one room and you have a non-Chinese speaker in the other room. And the person who doesn't speak Chinese has to translate something into Chinese. One word at a time, they write a word on a piece of paper and they slip it through the door, and the person in the Chinese thing translates it into Chinese and returns it, and you build up the message that way, right? And then you give the people who wanted the Chinese translation, you give it to them. But the person who's done the translation, the non-Chinese speaker, they don't understand what they've done. They've just, like, done it through a process.
Right.
So this is the idea of how to define artificial intelligence. Like, are robots able to think, or are they just running this process, this automated process, okay. Right? So what if you had something like that where we fed an artificial intelligence enough data that it could replicate Facebook and have all these people talking to each other?
Right.
But none of these people exist. There are no more people in the world, but there may as well be people,
but
because the same thing's
still
happening.
Running. Yeah, right. Windows has been left on.
Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah. Is that in The Matrix?
Oh, the Matrix is a similar
thing. Yeah, okay.
Right. So, yeah, but that's the third order, maybe, where you can't tell what's real. Right? Whereas maybe the fourth order is you get out of the Matrix, and instead of there being the real world, there just is no real world. There's
just
only
the Matrix.
Should have used that instead of the shit.
And Inception. Oh, no.
Correspondent science fiction. Yeah.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
Well, the other thing is specifically, this is all tied into the science fiction tropes, because Baudrillard, in this, not in the same essay, but in the same collection where he's trying to work out the simulacra, says that science fiction is part of this. Defines three other modes, and I haven't written these down. This is all coming off me now, so I might fuck this up. But this is the way simulacra are produced, and he says the first point is utopia.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the idea that there's another world that we should imitate. Then the second mode is science fiction, which is
an attempt.
Yeah, it's trying to connect ideals to the real world.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next version is postmodernism, where you can't tell what's real, what's different. Postmodern literature things. But I guess, like, that's fantasy, right? Like, he's talking about the ways people think. So these are different categories to what he's talking about earlier. But if we look at these four stages of simulation that he's defining in the Procession of Simulacra, if the first is an imitation, that's realist fiction, right? Yeah, no?
Yeah.
And then the second one, which is you can't tell them apart, like mm-hmm. what's real, what isn't. Maybe that is science fiction. It's saying it's a fantasy, but it's like the real world.
Mm-hmm.
Then the third order, where there is no real world, it's all just, that's postmodernism, right? And maybe postmodern science fiction.
Mm.
But then where everything is simulation, there is no real. He's talking about fantasy.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's a fantasy world.
Oh.
This is a complex postmodern French philosophy concept. But this is important and relevant because Baudrillard specifically uses Disneyland as an example to explain the simulacra. Do you want to read Baudrillard's description of Disneyland, Alice?
Sure do. Disneyland is a perfect model of all the entangled orders of simulacra. It is, first of all, a play of illusions and phantasms. But what attracts the crowds the most is, without a doubt, the social microcosm, the religious, miniaturized pleasure of real America, of its constraints and joys. Thus, everywhere in Disneyland, the objective profile of America, all its values are exalted by the miniature and the comic strip, embalmed and pacified. But this masks something else, and this ideological blanket functions as a cover for the simulation of the third order. Disneyland exists in order to hide that it is the real country, all of real America. Disneyland is presented as imaginary in order to make us believe that the rest is real, whereas all of Los Angeles and the America that surrounds it are no longer real, but belong to the hyper-real order and to the order of simulation. This world wants to be childish in order to make us believe that the adults are elsewhere, in the real world, and to conceal the fact that true childishness is everywhere, and it is adults themselves who come here to act the child in order to foster illusions as to their real childishness.
So I have no idea what he's saying.
Yeah, what the fuck, man? I get points of it.
Right, so what are you picking up there? You just read it.
Disneyland is the idea that it's right. Childishness.
Yeah.
And like, oh, there are no adults here, but there are adults. I don't know how that's a simulacra, though.
As Smith explains, to Baudrillard, America is postmodernism incarnate, and Disneyland exists to divert the attention in the same way that prisons tell citizens that they are free because they are not in prison. Disneyland tells citizens that rationality holds sway outside its boundaries. Yeah, the idea is that Disneyland's meant to be the fantasy, so it's the break from real life. But he's saying Disneyland is real life and the rest of America is a fantasy, which I sort of get. This is the thing where you define something by its opposite. Is I think what he's saying is the only reason that people don't go crazy in the real world, that they don't just go, this is all bullshit, is because we have this escape. the real doesn't exist without the escape to run away to.
So we need a simulacra?
Well, I don't know where the simulacra comes in, because it's not simulating the real world, it's just balancing it. But I guess I guess what he's saying is the American dream is a fantasy.
Yes.
Like, the world is a magical kingdom. Yeah, this is what Pratchett's saying, is that everyone in their day-to-day lives is playing out this story, is playing out this fantasy that has a happy ending at the end.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that makes sense. You're just not saying it very clearly at all.
I couldn't tell if that was great writing or terrible writing.
It's terrible. Waterlord's fucking impossible.
I feel better.
So as we discussed at the end of part one of the podcast on Witches Abroad, the Wizard of Oz author Alfank Baum talked about buying an island and building a utopian Oz theme park on it, which obviously Disney did with his theme parks. But along with the Disneyland and Disney World theme parks, Disney also attempted to establish the Experimental Prototype Community of Tomorrow Project, or EPCOT, which became the Tomorrowland attraction and that terrible movie at Florida Disney World, which Jenny was based on, and turned into its surrounding township of Celebration, which was established in the 1990s. So this is Disney attempting to set up a utopian commune to live by the morals that he is preaching in the Disney films.
But it doesn't work, does it? Because it's only an idealized version of it. It can't ever be real.
I mean, I have no idea, man. but I guess I'm bringing this up to say that Disney didn't just see this as a fantasy. He was trying to build an idealized, not just an idealized escape. He was trying to build an idealized township.
I guess like the Genua. Point is Disney's idealized township actually an idealized township, or is it just Disney's idealized
township? Well, it's Disney's idealized township, okay. Does Lilith sort of flip this? She wants to say that Disneyland is the real world. I'm not sure. Do you have any thoughts about...
I guess that's the point. Genua is represented as real, even though it's actually made up of all of these stories that we recognise, and then we sort of forget that they're stories because they become real characters, so it becomes a simulacra. Yeah, am I getting it?
Yeah, I don't know. I have absolutely no idea.
Yeah? That works though, doesn't it?
Sorry, hang on. Walk me through that again.
In Genua, it's made up of all of these different stories, but we kind of lose the original stories because of the relation, like the way Pratchett knits these stories together into something new that kind of replaces the thing.
Right, so they're like imitations of things. So they're simulations of fairy tales.
Yeah, but then it becomes something new, so the old ones kind of get lost.
Okay, I think I'm following you now. Let's abstract this away from Pratchett's perspective. Specifically, if we're just talking about revised fairy tales in general, they are a copy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, a copy, essentially. If we go away from Pratchett, like the Grimms are writing, we've copied out all the folklore, here is the version of the story. It's an imitation of folklore.
Mm-hmm.
But then everyone forgets about folklore and the Grimm's tale becomes the original, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And then the same now with Disney. Now everyone thinks fairy tales are about true love's first kiss because that's what Disney has perpetuated.
Yeah, and it has replaced.
Yes.
Yeah!
Yes!
I did it!
Yeah. I'll solve simulacras, everybody.
Leave that in!
Oh, yeah. We're cutting this bit out.
Okay, well, I went from not understanding a few hours ago to...
Do you see why I think gothic fiction is all simulacra now?
Yeah, I get it now. Okay. Also, all heroic archetypes. Shit.
This might seem only tangentially related to Witches Abroad. However... In his 1992 essay, Elves Were Bastards, which we'll talk about a lot more when we get to Lords and Ladies, for obvious reasons, Pratchett says, I'm writing this in Florida, home of fantasy. They've got some weird stuff here. For one thing, they've got Disney, MGM, and Universal Studios. And this is what's weird about them. They aren't really studios. Oh, they shoot some film here, but that's kind of secondary. They weren't built as studios. They were built as, well, as theme parks. Those false frontages, those awful backlots, those false perspective streets... They were built for no other purpose than to look like something, which in turn was built to look like something.
Shit.
Built to look like something that isn't real. Here in America, and in England to a lesser extent, you can read newspaper articles and buy alleged books which treat the characters played by TV stars as if they were real people. The world has gone strange. You can't tell the reality from the fantasy anymore.
All right, Pratchett.
Yeah.
All right. So, yeah, really, like, any film that, you know, if we watch, like, a lot of American films or a lot of English films and that becomes your understanding of England, that replaces the England.
Yes.
Oh, no!
Yeah.
Oh!
The other thing to apply to more reality is stuff like things like Arnold Schwarzenegger becoming the governor of California.
Yeah.
Because people think he is the guy from the movies. They don't understand. Like, his personality and his movie characters are now just one thing, and they think they've elected...
YouTube sensations, I think, are a good example of that as well. Like, it's so... The line between reality and fiction on YouTube is so thin.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, that's any kind of performance. This is why the Witches books are about the theatre, right? Because it's all pretend. But even then, like, it's acknowledged that it's pretend.
Interesting.
But yeah, things like the cult of celebrity And, yeah, things like the Kardashians, where people who are famous for being famous or whatever, it's that idea that there is no original. They're just celebrity. This might be so confusing because we're living in it. Like, maybe if you're in the 60s, you can play with these thought experiments more objectively.
I'm sure, but there's like a 60s version.
Oh, yeah. There was the crying of Lot 49 and things. But, like, we're just like, yeah. that's how shit happens now.
I'm broken. God.
Oh, by the simulacra
thing? Yeah, nothing's real anymore.
Nothing was ever real, Alice. That's the point.
Oh, no.
Cool. So yeah, that's part two. Next episode, the final part, we're going to talk about mirrors, we're going to shit on psychoanalysis.
Yeah!
We're going to talk about Lilith. We're going to talk about Granny Weatherwax's bullshit imperialism.
Woo.
We're going to talk about Miss Goggle. Then if you enjoyed us going off the deep end about simulacras, I've got a crazy theory about the power of carnival and pastiche versus parody. Get into it.
Put a pin in it.
Nice.
And we're clear. That's all for this episode of Unseen Academicals. There'll be another one along in a month, but if you can't wait until then, you can sign up to our Patreon page and get all the episodes a full month in advance, along with any bonus episodes or specials that we end up doing. If you're after more of us, Alice hosts her own podcast, Of the Devil's Party, which traces the development of the satanic hero throughout romantic and gothic literature. Links to a bibliography for today's show, along with a fully referenced and footnoted transcript, should be available in the episode description. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned for some amusing outtakes.
Now, if I can pull a Columbo again and say just one more thing about The Princess and the Frog. So the Crocodile Lewis, who wants to be the jazz musician in The Princess and the Frog. Right, now he recalls King Louis from The Jungle Book.
Yep.
Whose portrayal has been criticized for being a stereotype of black jazz musicians.
Ah.
And he's named after Louis Armstrong.
Yep.
Who they wanted to cast in The Jungle Book, but they didn't want to cast a black person as an ape. So he was played by the white jazz singer Louis Prumy instead.
Is that worse somehow?
Yeah, I don't really know where I fall down on that one. Yeah. Probably, it's not great. He was from New Orleans, so that's just a coincidence there. I am going somewhere with this, I promise. In The Princess and the Frog, though, Louis the trumpet playing crocodile isn't played by someone named Louis. Instead, he's played by the African-American actor Michael Leon Woolley, who is the bitch on blind guy!
Oh, really?
Yeah. So, for
people are going to need context.
For context on that, there was a terrible sitcom starring RuPaul, released last year, I think, maybe the year before, called AJ and the Queen. It was about a road trip buddy series between RuPaul, the drag queen, and a small child. But RuPaul's housemate, who's this guy, is Louis, and he's blind. He's not real. The actor's not blind. He's blind in the show. And all he does is once an episode, it will cut back to the to what Louis is doing in the apartment, and he'll be doing something where he's blind. And the punchline is always, he yells, "Bitch, I'm blind!" That's his catchphrase. Which has become a thing that me and my partner, Maddie, say all the time, because I got glasses, and whenever I'm looking for my glasses, I ask, where are my glasses? Because, bitch, I'm blind. And I have tried to share this with Alice, and now it's become a simulacra, because
I say it wrong.
Alice has never seen this show. Just says, "I'm blind, bitch."
I get it the wrong way around, don't I?
Yeah.
That's the problem. Yeah. Bitch, I'm blind.
Oh, Louis, that is way too big.
Oh, well, how am I supposed to know? I'm blind, bitch.
Interestingly, though, his character, the bitch on blind guy, his name is also Louis.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, so, Louis all the way down.
I know. Is that a reference to Princess and the Frog? Like, this is the guy who was Louis in that movie? Who knows? Alice is just staring at me. That doesn't pick up on the microphone.
Is the Lion King, is Nala a Disney princess?
Nala wasn't, no. Because she was not human.
Wow.
Also, I think she would score low because they scored on the Huey categories.
Yeah.
There was attitude, but there's more. Oh, autonomy, attitude, aria, so songs, attire, outfit. There was another A1, which I can't remember, which I'll remember soon. Oh, animal companions. And then zombie apocalypse.
Well, clearly Pocahontas wins.
Pocahontas was up there. I still think Jasmine.
Jasmine's pretty cool, but she doesn't
She's
have a lot
hot,
of...
She can pole vault, and she has a pet tiger. What more do you want?
Pet tiger's pretty good.
Yeah, and she can pole vault. Let's not forget. But we're going to do Nala right now. I think Nala gets real low because autonomy. She does nothing of her own accord.
She goes off to find Simba on
I
her own.
I think she's Sam.
She goes off on her own.
You reckon?
Yeah, she's like, fuck you, Scar, I'm going to find Simba.
So part of the thing is with the autonomy, like, do their decisions drive the plot?
She has to go find Johansson for bringing him back.
Yeah, but no. So I would give her like a 2
okay.
for a time.
All right.
I mean, you can. I'll go with. Nah, I can't go higher than a 2 because she does. She's one scene. She makes one decision.
I go 5 because it's pretty important for the film. Out of 10.
It doesn't drop the plot of the
You've
film.
You've got to get Simba back to get Scar out of the Pride Lands.
There's so much more plot.
Yeah, but Simba coming back is very. Nah. And then she has to convince him to come back as well because he's like, nah, Hakuna Matata, baby.
No, but that's like saying because Sleeping Beauty was the lowest one.
Right.
She got 12 out of a possible 30.
Good.
Because she's asleep for the whole movie. But that's like saying her decision, her going to sleep drove the plot, therefore she gets 5 for a time.
I disagree, but okay, moving on.
I don't think she gets it. So then what was the other one? Attitude? Nala? Mm. I think she's a bit proper.
I like Nala.
She's always like, Simba, stop, be proper, act real. What would you give her? Out of 5?
Probably another 5.
A 5 for attitude? Yeah. I'll go as high as a 3.5.
Okay.
Well, I mean, I don't have the
I told thing. You I wouldn't support Nala, and I'm now behind Rapunzel, or I was behind Rapunzel.
No, I'm not talking Rapunzel. We're talking Nala.
Yeah, I know, but like, you're acting like a...
Like, you would hang out with Nala.
I hang out with Nala. She's a fucking talking tiger cub.
You're giving her perfect points so far.
Out of 10. I'm going out of 10. Okay. Is it out of 5?
No, it's out of 5.
Oh, shit.
Yeah.
Okay, so 2.5 and then 2.5.
Okay, yeah, now we're on the same page.
All right,
page.
We're there. Okay, I told you before, out of 10. Okay.
No, out of 5.
This is all being recorded.
Okay, now we're back on the same page. And then, so, all right, she doesn't get a song. Does Nala get a song? I don't think Nala sings a song.
She's part of songs.
Is she?
Yeah.
No, Jibets count, but she doesn't like, does she ever sing? I think maybe she's in a
I think
bit
in
of
the
a
new
just
one. Yeah, and in the new one, she's at the end when they do the reprise of Circle of Life.
Not Beyonce. We're talking Nala now.
I'm pretty sure it is in the old one as well. I just can't remember.
I think she sings a little bit of I Just Can't Wait to Be King. So like 2. Again, she's flat 2s. Animal companions. She has Zazu. No, Simba has Zazu.
Zazu is with Nala when she goes to
okay,
find Simba.
Okay, alright, so Zazu. What do we rate Zazu?
He's pretty cool.
You like Zazu?
I like Zazu.
About 4.
Sire.
4 for
Zazu.
Okay. And then outfit. She's naked. She's a lion, so
stop
no points.
Fur. It's well...
She doesn't have particular fur, right? She's just a lion. Okay. I don't think you can give her attire points.
Okay.
She's naked!
Yeah. Just feel bad.
Now, final. Zombie apocalypse. Capabilities.
She's fucking lion.
Right, but I don't think that is a good...
She's gonna be fine.
You reckon lion beats zombie?
Yeah, faster.
Zombies don't feel pain.
Faster.
Well, are they running zombies? Are they Day of the Dead zombies? I think as a lion goes to bite a zombie, gets infected.
I think the lions would just run away. They're cats. They're like, fuck this, I'm out.
No, they're lions.
But they're big cats.
They're ambush predators.
But they're big cats.
They would run at a zombie, chomp him, rotten zombie meat, dead.
Do you get infected by eating a zombie?
Yeah, definitely.
In what?
I don't know, but definitely.
This is a Josh. Okay.
I will find precedent, but like there's no way you don't get infected.
Interesting.
Because then they do a follow-up podcast, which was Disney Villain Deathmatch. And this really was like, if they fought, who wins, right?
Yes.
Now, that one I haven't listened to, but I do know the end. I don't know who wins. I know who the finalists are. Because if you Google it, it comes up with, it tells you, here's our episode where we decide between the two finalists who are. Now, before we reveal that, unless you've just looked at it.
No, I haven't.
Right. So, thinking off my head, I went straight away, your winner, Jafar.
Yeah.
He's a planet juggling genie. Like, I don't think you can top that.
Yeah, you're right. Yep. Hard
so
to do.
I was like, who's going to be Jafar? And I thought Maleficent and Ursula, like, they're magical powers, right? But then Hades, right? He's the god of the underworld. I still think Jafar wins because Hades is incapable.
I was going to say probably Hades.
But I thought they're clearly your two most powerful thing. Now, I don't know where Hades ends up, but the finalists, Jafar and Scar.
What?
I thought Scar would be first out on account of being a lion. Like, he's just an old shitty lion.
Yeah.
Unless he just overwhelms him with the powers of Camp. But even then, Hades has got him. And Ursula. So I don't know who wins
Captain
out of
Hook,
Jafar and...
Gaston.
I just figured there's tiers, right? You got, like, your men. Like, your Gastons and everything.
Yeah.
Just your regular
useless
people.
Men.
Regular
yeah.
humans. Then you've got witches.
Yeah.
It's their, like, Maleficent thing. Then you've got literal gods. So Jafar and Hades.
Yeah.
And then below all that is Lion.
I mean, Scar has a good song, though. He has one of the best villain songs.
Right, if you're going with just who is the coolest villain, Scar's right up there. If this was literally, like, who would win in a fight, like, Gaston beats Scar, right? Human beats Lion.
No, Scar needs to beat Gaston just for me. I need that to sleep at night. Gaston's such a prick. I want to see him mauled by a lion.
Does Gaston have a sword?
No.
Right, so maybe he beats Gaston. Well, yeah! Scar is dead.
He doesn't get the
sure.
gun. It's a fist fight. Scar wins.
Because he's buff as shit. Even then, I reckon
Gaston's
the kind of
out.
Guy who's
what?
Like
Scar's
good.
Scar's also cunning. He'd be like, look, a hot guy. And Gaston would be like, where?
Scar gets to the finals by luring everyone into a false sense of security and pushing them off a cliff.
He's the Odysseus of...
Every single Scarfight begins with, there's a stampede!
The other fairy tale that I needed to look up after... Pun? The only thing a flaccid penis absolutely cannot create.